Good morning. With a week to go until the next administration takes office, Congress is setting up to scrap Obamacare, but what will replace it? Economist John C. Goodman tells us about his health care plan. Meanwhile, Hawaii Representative Chris Lee is championing a bill to require presidential candidates to release tax returns. He joins us this hour, as does Keith Reagan, the chair of the Sugar Operators Support Task Force, to look beyond the group's initial report. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. We'll have conversations with two virtuoso musicians this morning. Pianist Wu Han, a co-artistic director of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, prepares two Hawaii concerts. And trumpeter Chris Bodie looks back on the years of dues paying that preceded his international fame.
It's Friday, January 13th. The conversation starts after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris. We've got quite a potent day. It's the 13th.
That's right.
Friday the 13th.
That's
we
right.
have a full moon.
Yeah.
Gee, what could happen?
Well, I'd say stay home, pull up the covers, and put the pillow over your head.
I'll listen to good radio. There you go.
That's it. Exactly. We still haven't seen the president-elect's tax returns.
No, we haven't, and it may be a good bet that we're really not going to.
Probably,
but
yeah.
That doesn't mean that there might not be that opportunity the next time around. Now, according to President-elect Trump, most Americans don't care that he hasn't released his tax returns. We heard that in the press conference. But according to a Pew Research Center poll, they do, 60% of them, in fact. As the sparring continues, one Hawaii lawmaker wants to be sure this won't be an issue next time in 4 years. Representative Chris Lee announced this week he'll introduce a bill to require future presidential candidates to release their tax returns in order to be placed on the ballot in Hawaii. He says there are a few other states doing the same in California, New York, Massachusetts, and a few other states. We talked after his announcement, and I asked him whether the move is a long shot.
It only takes one state to act to provide transparency to the entire country, to ensure that the highest office in the land and the president is making decisions on behalf of people and not at the expense of taxpayers to boost their own bottom line or cut a deal for one of their own companies. It's been frustrating for a lot of folks seeing a lot of delays over how the president's going to move forward, creating a firewall that maintains solid ethical footing to ensure that his companies and those relationships with his family that is running those companies aren't going to impact the decisions being made on behalf of the people.
Yesterday, during the press conference, Mr. Trump said that Americans really don't care that he hasn't released his tax returns, most Americans, that is. But according to the Pew Research Center, that's not necessarily true, that 60% of Americans think that he should release his returns, and 33% said that he doesn't have a responsibility to do so. But it really was split along partisan lines. Do you expect that same kind of split to be the response to the measure that you want to put out?
You know, I don't. I think, especially here in Hawaii, we recognize that this isn't about Democrats or Republicans, because if we take this step and require transparency in this manner, it affects any Democrat or Republican president moving forward. And I think that's something that everybody can agree on. We are one country. We are all Americans. The president, whether they're from our party or another, is the president of us all. And we have an obligation, I think. We have to hold that highest office at the highest regard and make sure that there's no conflicts of interest. We've seen, I think, a lot to raise some concerns about that this go-around, where you've had a number of appointments, some political insiders and CEOs and others that have serious and significant potential conflicts that have been raised. There's not much that can be done, but what we can do for the future is ensure that at least the tax returns and the funding that the president's receiving personally, we can ensure won't compromise some of the decisions that are going to be made on behalf of us all.
So, Representative Lee, what happens, for example, if this were to pass in Hawaii or even in one or two other states, or what happens if it doesn't pass at all?
Well, I think if it passes in one or two states, whoever runs for president the next time around, whether it's President-elect Trump or a Democrat or anybody else, they would have to release their tax returns, just as every president in modern history up until now has done, so that the public can plainly see that there's no immediate conflicts of interest that would be raised. And if it doesn't pass, and there does happen to be somebody running, or President Trump runs again the next time, a lot of these questions could persist and would only create a lot of disillusionment in this already very difficult political climate. And I think we'd rather go the route of transparency. That's something that we have an obligation to do on behalf of everybody here.
The question sort of remains, is this going to make a difference in the short term? Is this going to set any sort of precedent that people will hearken to and remember once we're even 6 months into the presidency of Donald Trump?
You know, I don't think it'll make an immediate difference, because I just personally don't believe the president's come this far and refused to disclose his own personal financial ties. I don't think anything we do now is going to change that. But 4 years from now, the next election, if we do pass something, it could. And I think that's something that perhaps at that time could answer a lot of the questions about some of the decisions that have been made over the next 4 years. That's something I think that could have an effect at that time.
Given the composition of our state and of our state legislature, relative ease in being able to see this move through?
You know, I would never say anything's easy here, even though it's a fairly Democratic state. But I do think the discussion at the national level certainly is being felt here, even as remote as we are from Washington, D.C. Again, if we are one of just a handful of states that even moves this, it does create transparency for the entire nation. And I think that's something that we can do as a state, where we have the opportunity to move something forward. And I think that's something at least a few of my colleagues so far have seemed to understand.
So when will the other states also put forth their measures that are in concert with ours? Is that happening also this year?
Yeah, there's a few of them that are moving forward, and their legislative sessions are typically a little bit different than ours in timing, but generally early this year, these things will be moving in states around the country.
Well, we're going to be watching that and see how it happens, not only in Hawaii, but how it looks nationally, too. Thanks very much for the time.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
Representative Chris Lee is currently the chair of the Committee on Energy and Environmental Protection and is introducing a bill to require future presidential candidates to release their tax returns in order to be placed on the ballot in Hawaii. But before we get to that point, it's a good bet health care will look different from what it is now. As Congress is poised to repeal the ACA, the big question is, what will replace it? Economist John C. Goodman is in Hawaii this week to talk about his proposal. When we spoke, I asked him if all the talk of repeal and replace without a solid replacement plan is setting up Republicans for failure.
Well, I think they're in disarray. And it's been 7 years since Obamacare passed. And all that 7 years, they haven't been able to agree on a replacement plan. They were not expecting to win the presidential election, but they did win. And so now there's enormous pressure on them to come up with a replacement plan. They don't have one. They can't agree on the particulars. And that's bad for them, but it's also bad for the country.
And how bad is it for Hawaii? I mean, Hawaii has had prepaid health care. At one time was, you know, leading the nation in that idea. And the big fears here were that in having Obamacare, that somehow we would have less than. Now we've just gotten a waiver so that we don't have to have the shop portion. But in Hawaii especially, there seems to be this idea that, well, you know, we did this whole thing, and what has it really gotten us?
You're the only state that got an exemption from ERISA. And that exemption allowed the state of Hawaii to do something no other state can do, and that's insist that your large companies provide health insurance and dictate what that health insurance has to look like. No other state can do that.
And that was kind of the point going into this, why some were making the case that we should have pushed harder for a waiver to not be part of Obamacare. And who knows what may even what Obamacare may even look like as we go forward. But in Hawaii especially, there seems to be this idea that, well, you know, we did this whole thing, and what has it really gotten us?
Well, it's gotten you along the way to reform. Now, what Republicans are thinking about doing is passing a bill that defunds Obamacare, takes all the money away, but delays that for 3 years and maybe 4 years. And the problem there is that insurers are already losing. I don't know if they're losing money in Hawaii. They probably are, but they're losing a lot of money in other places. Blue Cross of Texas has lost $1 billion. And to ask them to keep on losing money with no certainty about what's going to happen is asking a lot. So what the Republicans risk is creating a lot of uncertainty, scaring insurers out of the market. They're already leaving anyway.
So with insurers bailing, and certainly we've had that conversation in Hawaii for the last several years, and with the fact that this may be something that ends up being a failure on the part of Republicans because there's nothing to replace it that anybody can look at or assess, what do you see as a prudent course forward?
Oh, well, I helped Pete Sessions, who's head of the House Rules Committee, and Bill Cassidy, who's probably the most knowledgeable person about health care in the Senate, and I helped them put together a bill that would replace Obamacare. And it takes all the money in Obamacare because we need all that money. But then we use it in a much more intelligent way. And we would give everybody a refundable tax credit, and it would be the same amount for everybody regardless of income. And in the individual market, there should be at least one plan that you can buy for that credit without adding additional money of your own. And it'll look something like Medicaid. But at least we will have universal coverage. There won't be any reason for anybody to be uninsured.
And what happens to those who were part of the Medicaid expansion?
In our bill, over an eight-year period, we equalize the amount of money for Medicaid going to all the states. Right now, it's very unfair, and some states get way too much, and other states get too little. So we want to equalize it. But we also don't want people to be trapped in Medicaid, so we would allow people to leave Medicaid, get their tax credit, and get private insurance. And we would also allow something else. About two-thirds of all the people in Medicaid are actually in a private plan right now. And we would allow those private plans to be part of the exchange, part of the individual market. And so if a family had Medicaid and their income got too high, which happens all the time, they could stay in that same plan. And so as their income goes up and down, the help from government may change, but they don't have to get out of the plan and then back in it.
And what about those who are on Medicare? In Hawaii, we are one of the longest live states. We have many, many people who are in Medicare. How do you see Medicare going forward, given the fact that people are routinely told how many other riders they have to be able to get medical care?
Well, Medicare needs to be reformed. But we felt like reforming Obamacare and reforming Medicare is too much to take on in a single bill. So we don't. And the bill I'm talking about with Sessions and Cassidy is solely focused on the population below age 65. But we do need to, once we get that done, we definitely do need some reforms for Medicare.
For Hawaii in particular, do you see a different course of action than for the rest of the country, given the fact that we have the history of the prepaid health plan?
Yeah, in our bill, we give enormous discretion to the states. So if you like in Hawaii the way the Obamacare exchange is working, Hawaii will be able to continue it. But if you don't like the way it's working, you can make radical changes to it, and we're going to allow that. We know that the exchanges have a race to the bottom. By race to the bottom, I mean that the quality is going down, the networks are getting narrow as the premiums spiral upwards. Average premium has doubled in the last 4 years across the country. So some of the exchanges are in danger of going into a death spiral. So we need radical surgery in many places, and we have some thoughts on how to do that. But we give the states a lot of discretion.
Would that include the discretion to not participate at all?
Well, we offer a federal tax credit, and you can't get the tax credit unless you have health insurance. So I can't imagine anyone turning that down.
No, the reason I'm asking is because for Hawaii, there are some people who think that, well, you know, we were pretty good before Obamacare. Couldn't we just go back to that, what we had before with the prepaid health care?
Pretty much you can, plus it's even better than that. We get rid of the employer mandate, and we get rid of the individual mandate under Obamacare. So if you want to, you can have the employers being your mandated employer coverage. And then, as I understand, there are a lot of people in Hawaii who don't get covered because they're part-time workers. And for other reasons, they have to go to the individual market. All those people would get a tax credit. And for that matter, all the people at work would get a tax credit. So we're focused more on the funding. We want to get rid of the regulations. We want to make sure the money is there. And we would give Hawaii a lot of discretion on what to do with it, a lot more than you have now.
I want to thank you for the time that you were able to give us this morning.
Glad to be with you.
John C. Goodman is an economist and founding chief executive of the National Center for Policy Analysis. It's a free market think tank. He's in Hawaii this week to talk about his proposal to replace Obamacare.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:19, and coming up in the show, a visit from one of chamber music world's busiest performers. But first, your quiz.
In today's show, we'll be hearing from not one but two talented musicians, Chris Botti and Wu Han. Since we clearly have music on the brain, that's where we're going in today's Backyard Quiz. We're remembering a man not born in Hawaii, but one who made Hawaii his home. He got his start playing country music and joined the Grand Ole Opry in 1944. He quickly became known for his talent on the steel guitar, giving lessons to such notable musicians as guitarist Jimmy Vaughn and Jerry Garcia. In the 1970s, our mystery musician moved to Hawaii and went to work on reviving Hawaiian steel guitar music. Once here, he played a weekly gig at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel and gave steel guitar lessons to dozens of aspiring musicians, including Hawaii virtuoso Bobby Ngano. Do you know the name of this music man? If you think you do, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right gets the prize.
Hi, this is DJ Mr. Nick, host of Bridging the Gap. One of the things I love about the islands and Hawaii Public Radio is diversity. At HPR, our goal is to bring you a variety of viewpoints from voices you might not have otherwise heard. Public radio lets them speak for themselves so that you can draw your own conclusions. It's smart, like you, and listener support makes it possible. Become a member today. Renew or increase your contribution at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
Pianist Wu Han is a full-fledged ambassador of chamber music, expanding its worldwide audience through her performances with her husband, cellist David Finkel, and her work as co-artistic director of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. She's in Hawaii for shows on two islands, and she's with us in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's
so great to be here.
Well, it's good to have you.
Yep.
You hear all the time about the shrinking audience for classical music, and
yep.
You've been able to expand it, so what's your secret?
Well, I feel very privileged that, the organization I have been involved, Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, and also Music in Menlo and Chamber Music Today Festival in Korea, all are blossoming, and we all have subscription increase in the last 8 years, which is a miracle.
It really is.
In the music industry. I think the trick is really establish a great relationship and a great trust with your community and your audience. Mm-hmm. So every time they come to the concert, they will always know it's the highest quality of the concert making and the music making. And we have been very much focused not on the soloist or the big name fan kind of a base, because we know if you go there, they will only come for the big names.
For the celebrities.
For the celebrities, yeah. So we have concentrated very much on the essence of the music itself. Earlier, we were having a conversation about Archduke Trio.
Yeah.
So our goal is always introduce them and get them engaged with them, repertoire themselves.
Yeah.
And you hire, you promise them you will find the best musician to play them. You'll have a great experience. You learn about the difference in interpretation. You learn really truly about what music, the essence of the music is. And we end up developing pockets of very enthusiastic and very devoted music listener, and who is truly engaged with music itself, not just coming to watch the celebrity.
Yeah, or dress up. Or,
exactly.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating journey.
Yeah.
It's a very different approach in programming and in concert presenting. And I'm just so grateful and happy that people trusted me and liking the concerts all the time.
That really is the key, is having the audience trust you, because inevitably you're making choices for them.
Yes.
And you're also exposing them to repertoire they're not familiar with.
Absolutely. And that's what artist director's job is.
Yeah.
For me to set directions for the organization and also set the basic principle and mission to function. So both all the organization I have been involved in all function under that very pure and non-commercial but very true to the heart and true to the art form kind of a mission and principle. I think people recognize quality. I would never underestimate any of my audience ability to enjoy, appreciate the highest, greatest achievement of human mankind, which in my opinion is music.
Couldn't agree more. At the same time, you know, a lot of people see unfamiliar, have difficulty with music with which they're not familiar,
yes.
Right? They,
you know, it's interesting you mentioned that, because you think of arts consumers or you think of our general community, when you see an unfamiliar name in arts, in visual arts, let's say, or in movies, you're always curious, right?
Yeah.
So I have to assume people that are intelligent and curious and a great true arts consumer will be curious about unfamiliar work.
Yeah.
So it's encourage people to take that first step, and in order for them to enter the door. Another thing I always tell my audience and tell all my people around me is just like good food. You need knowledge, or good wine. That's another good example.
Uh-huh.
Food and wine, you need knowledge to be able to appreciate that.
Yeah.
If you don't try new things like another exotic cheese or incredible vintage of wine, or if you don't have knowledge about wine, you were only plucking the surface. But once as a connoisseur of music consumer, the reward is so great. And it's really no difference than food and wine, in my opinion.
Well, once you start exploring cuisine or wine or anything like that, you surprise yourself with liking something you didn't think you'd like.
Correct.
You're encouraged to go further.
Correct. So you're exploring what life can offer to you.
Yeah.
And you're also exploring what music can offer to you. So don't be scared if it's a composer you might not know, knowing that if you go follow the best organization and the best musician, you will have the most rewarding experience.
You know, there's comfort in hearing a familiar piece.
Correct.
And audiences like that.
Yeah.
And sometimes there's a kind of a challenging piece you can encounter a certain amount of resistance.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes do you sometimes balance a concert with the familiar with the unfamiliar?
Oh, absolutely.
Sugarcoating the pill?
Absolutely. Well, I never really believe that you have to give people the medicine.
Uh-huh. Bad analogy.
That's not good. I think the trick is really have trust-building pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And they are entry points. It's a bit like when you try – I'll go back to the food analogies, okay? If one has always have hamburgers or normal food consuming, you will never have the – you have to introduce them to the new cuisine first in the best restaurant, the best representation of the cuisine.
Yeah, that's right?
Right. And second, you want them to try things that is really tried and true, and you know it's going to give them the first incredible enjoyment out of the tasting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you introduce them slowly into the more exotic land once that palate is developed.
Right.
So
right.
It's the artistic director's message that you have to send out so people know what they are getting and they have the choice.
In a way, it sounds like you're taking a series of steps.
Yes,
toward
absolutely.
That goal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So programming is a great art form. And if you hit important artistic directors and you trust them, they will lead you into that beautiful world that I know the reward is it's the most it's endless.
Well, you've persuaded me.
So
I trust you already.
Come to our concert.
Thanks so much for coming in. It's great to meet you.
Thank you.
Pianist Wu Han is the co-artistic director of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. She'll perform Sunday in the UH Hilo Auditorium, Monday in the Doris Duke Theater at the Honolulu Museum of Art. And you can find out more about her on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Death and taxes may be unavoidable, but just how they happen could be a matter of choice in the next legislative session. Death with dignity is again before lawmakers, and so are some tax changes. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a double reality check. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy Aloha Friday, Bethann.
And you too. Let's talk about death with dignity first. Last night on Town Square, the subject of part of the reality check this morning John Radcliffe was on with us, and longtime lobbyist. Now he has stage 4 cancer. He's also the person on whose behalf the lawsuit was filed earlier this week. And he's saying that this should be really, well, it is the cause of his life, but that it should be for everyone else the cause of theirs too. How does that stack up with what lawmakers may be willing to do?
I talked to two lawmakers, Kalani English, the majority leader in the Senate, and Joe Suki, the speaker in the House, and it's two different points of view, frankly. English said, look, we've heard this before, death with dignity, physician-assisted suicide, or medical aid in dying, as some are now calling it, compassionate care. No matter the name, it has been an emotional issue. It's never passed before. Do we need to spend time, again, going over these emotional arguments? The counter-argument from Suki is, look, a lot of us are seeing our loved ones terminally ill, the terrible pain they are suffering. It's humane to give them the option to be able to get a medical prescription, to take a pill or to not take a pill to end their lives. And Suki said, ultimately, Radcliffe would make less of a difference than one's own personal religious or philosophical views.
Though, you know, we've also been hearing from a very vocal minority saying that, you know, based on religious grounds, this isn't something that they could countenance. But for those who have been polled in Hawaii and certainly nationally, Hawaii has one of the highest poll numbers, 80% of those polled in the last poll, which was done at the end of last year. And 69% of Americans generally are in favor of some form of medical aid in dying.
Whether we jump on what appears to be a growing bandwagon nationally remains to be seen. Remember, only 6 states have this as law. However, California is one of them, and they're always very influential. We'll see. The religious argument is a very powerful one. Joe Suki, for example, is Catholic. The Catholic Church, others are very influential here. They were instrumental in defeating previous legislation on medical aid in dying. But as I said, there does seem to be a growing trend in the other direction. Is it only a matter of time?
Okay, we're going to have to move on to taxes for the moment. A lot of people are thinking, well, you know, that GET extension, it's going to be with us forever, and kind of the idea of, well, told you so.
You know, I'm going to not make a bet on what's going to happen with the GET extension. There is talk about extending it in perpetuity, though. And the idea, of course, is to allow Oahu to pay for the rail system. But, you know, depends on what that money is used for. Some of it, one proposal is to direct it towards state transportation projects. There's a lot of infrastructure. But bottom line, most lawmakers seem to support the idea of funding rail all the way. Now, having said that, we'll see whether it gets out of committee, but that is going to be one of the biggest issues along with death and dignity.
All right. Next week, the legislature opens. We'll have lots more to talk about once it does. But meanwhile, we'll talk to you on Monday, too. Thanks very much. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Beth Ann. I appreciate it.
Chad Blair joins us with a reality check every day.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
In his first inaugural address, President Obama made a promise to the scientific community.
We'll restore science to its rightful place and wield technology's wonders to raise healthcare's quality and lower its cost.
I'm John Dankosky. Join me on Science Friday for a look at how Obama made good on that promise, from healthcare to basic research to climate change, plus a look at NASA's upcoming asteroid missions. It's on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11.
A year ago, 675 Hawaiian commercial and sugar workers on Maui knew they would soon be out of work. Alexander and Baldwin, the parent of HCNS, had announced they were shutting down sugar production by the end of 2016. The company also said it would help workers to explore what came next, and the Maui mayor's office created the Sugar Operators Support Task Force to help. Now, a year later, the task force has released its report on the status of the workers let go up to December 1st, but it didn't include the 346 workers discharged as of December 1st. Maui County Managing Director Keith Regan is the chair of the Sugar Operators Support Task Force. He joins us now on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Thanks for having me.
And thanks for being here. It's always disruptive when a company is shutting down, and this one perhaps more so than others, because it brought to an end sugar production in Hawaii, or effectively brought it to an end. For the workers who have found work, the 124 of them, that's great news. 45 of them retired. 15 workers are in training programs. 7 workers relocate outside of Maui, but that still leaves those 77 workers still searching for new employment. What's the status of those workers as of today?
You know, my understanding is that the transition team, which was put together by Alexander and Baldwin, continues to work with those individuals to try to match them with employment that they desire. But, you know, they are constantly working to try to find them employment within the community, and specifically what they want to do, because a lot of these workers had been with HCNS for many, many years, and they're experts in agriculture. But unfortunately, with HCNS closing, there's not a lot of other agricultural-type jobs available in this market. So, you know, they're constantly searching for various different types of jobs that they might be interested in. But the good thing for us is that Maui's economy is extremely strong right now, and so our unemployment rate is relatively low. And there are a lot of job opportunities out there. Our job right now, working with the transition team as part of and part of this task force, is to try to connect them with those jobs.
Keith Regan, as you look at the idea of, you know, workers in agriculture, there are lots of different levels of that. Where are these 77 workers at? At what level are they?
You know, I don't have the specific details because as a task force, we're not actually part of A&B or part of HCNS. We're kind of looking at it from a higher level in terms of what types of jobs that they're looking for. But a lot of them were out there working, from my understanding is, you know, they were working in the mill or they're working in the field operations as part of that process. So a lot of them have many, many years of doing that type of work and gaining that kind of experience. So, you know, it'd be great if we had another big agriculture industry where, you know, these individuals could easily transition over to. But that is one of the challenges.
But since you don't, the reality may be that they're going to have to transition into something else, which means they very well may need additional support and training. Why are so few of them then still not participating in the training program with only 15 workers of that initial group who are in training?
You know, that's a great question. And, you know, all we can do as part of this process is to offer this as a possible solution for them to be able to, you know, expand and to grow. But I think maybe some of them want to take a break for a little while. You know, I mean, they've been out there working. It's a tough job, and it may be that they're trying to, you know, just reinvent themselves and have a little bit of a break. But then, you know, everything remains available to them, so they can have access to, you know, various different programs. And as part of the task force, that was one of our jobs, was to try to identify what resources were available for them and put it in front of the employees so that they know where they can go to reach out and get help, and as well as to receive additional training and maybe get into a different type of employment, you know, a different type of job.
So what happens with the remaining 346 workers who weren't part of your initial report? The report came out over a month ago. Any word about what's happening with this second group?
Well, we just released the report on January 6th of 2017. But the employees that have been released, the 300-some-odd employees that were just recently released as part of the last layoff, we're going to continue to work with them. I know that A&B is going to continue to have their transition team work very closely with these individuals to try to get them placed. I'm very certain that there's going to be additional job fairs coming up for these individuals, and that's part of our role as a task force, is to make sure that we help to coordinate those job fairs and get employers out. We've had no problem getting employers to come out to the eight or so plus job fairs that we've held, so it's been very good. The community has come together. We have so many different agencies from federal, state, local level, as well as nonprofit and private sector, just participating to try to find a solution for these individuals.
Keith, can I interrupt you just for a second?
Yeah.
Because we're having a really hard time hearing you. So would you just make sure you're speaking right into the phone, because we want to hear what you have to say.
Absolutely.
So with these 346 workers who are not part, obviously, of the initial report, but now they've been out of work since December 1st, many of them were the ones who were seeing the last harvest out and now are going off to whatever's next for them. Any sense of how many of them were involved or would possibly be involved with additional trainings or other things since you've learned something from that first initial group?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think if you look at the numbers and you look at the statistics that we've been able to put together, it's pretty indicative of what we anticipate in terms of individuals participating in some of our training programs that are out there and available to them here locally. But what we want to do is make sure that we encourage them. You know, we do as much as we can to help them reinvent themselves and have access to these programs. And so that's all we can do from a task force side. And the transition team really is key because they know these individuals. They've worked with these individuals. They know how to connect them with the right resources. What we do as a task force is provide them access to those resources and at least put that out there in front of them.
You have many people who are deeply involved with Hawaii's economy and Maui's economy, involved with the task force.
Yes.
Looking at from that macro level, when you say, okay, the economy is good right now, but we also know that we've been in a good economy for a while and
yes.
that we may be nearing the end of that time and moving into a time where it will not be so good. So getting people into jobs where, you know, they would have stability would be in everybody's interest. Are you at all looking at it from that macro perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we're not looking just for a short-term, you know, kind of employment for these individuals. We want them to have long-term employment. And we understand that the economy is cyclical, and that's part of this business, this world that we're in, right? So It's very important that we try to provide them with access to the ability to educate and then develop new skills that are in demand.
All right. Well, we're going to check back with you. We've got to go at the moment. Forgive me. But we'll check back with you as further reports come out and really wanting to hear where these people land. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Beth Ann. Aloha.
Aloha. Keith Regan is the chair of the Sugar Operators Support Task Force. He also serves as the managing director of Maui County.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Hawaii Pacific University and Ulupono Initiative.
Today in the Backyard Quiz, we asked you to name a steel guitarist who helped popularize the instrument in contemporary Hawaiian music. He was born in Lima, Ohio, and got his start playing country music, touring with the Grand Ole Opry, playing with such country music greats as Hank Williams, Dolly Parton, and Ernest Tubb. In the 1970s, he moved to Honolulu, where he set out to revive the use of steel guitar here, produced more than a dozen albums of steel guitar and Hawaiian music over 50 years, while playing weekly live shows at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel in Waikiki. In 1978, he was inducted into the Steel Guitar Hall of Fame, and in 2005, Jerry Bird died in Honolulu after a 30-year battle with Parkinson's disease.
And Jerry Bird was the name we were looking for. Jane Gallagher called us from Kailua and knew it, and will be receiving the prize. If you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and it just might show up on a future show.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000. The 2017 Literacy Leadership Conference and student celebrations are February 6th through 9th on Kauai, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Oahu. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
It takes a lifetime of effort to make what you do look easy. That's a mantra that could apply to any endeavor, but it's especially true of the trumpet, an especially demanding instrument. Trumpeters have to keep their chops up, and every day without practice, you get worse. Chris Botti labored for years playing clubs, even playing Christmas carols on the street, before finding international fame, and we talked about his journey.
When I look back at my career, obviously when I first started out, you know, you want to become great at your instrument, you want to be able to play jazz, you want to be able to, you know, have a gig, so to speak.
Yeah.
But when you're actually sitting there trying to figure out or thinking that you might have the opportunity to reach a wide audience, and the way you do that, whoever all those people that you mentioned were, you know, Louis Armstrong or Big Spiderbeck or Chet Baker or Jerry sure. Mulligan or all the instrumentalists that had, like, very big fame, Glenn Miller, of course. There was some sort of musical fingerprint that they had that the whole national public could say, well, when Louis Armstrong played his trumpet, everyone knew it was him.
Yeah.
Now, there are so many amazing musicians in the world that are great players, but they may not have that one fingerprint that everyone recognizes.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to get that fingerprint, I think there is something else that happens, like they call the stars aligning or fate or whatever, that luck, which is a large part of it.
Sure.
And I think that the rarity of that to happen, it makes it viable for that person, the good fortune for that to happen. And that's in many ways what happened to me, and it happened much later in my career, and I'm very aware of that good fortune.
Part of that, I think what you just described, is being able to inject a personality into the sound of an instrument.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, you're making a more, my statement about a fingerprint is a little more esoteric, but what you're saying is exactly spot on, and they go hand in hand with that.
Yeah, because as you mentioned, Louis Armstrong, you kind of know what kind of person he is. You can feel the joy, the kind of, there's a celebration of life in every note that he plays. And it's like, I don't know how it is that comes across to people, but it does.
Absolutely. And then Chet Baker had his, you know, vulnerability, and Miles had his broodiness and all that. You could feel, you know, you could kind of get a sense for that on all the players.
Yeah. I don't know if anybody can really define where that comes from, except that you just kind of, for the player, you just have to kind of immerse yourself in your craft, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're a musician, you keep your head down, you work, and you don't necessarily think about that sort of thing first. I mean, I never really thought about, you know, is my trumpet have the ability to reach a large mass audience until way, you know, we're talking about like till I was 42 years old, you know.
Sure.
And so between ages of 12 to 42, I was thinking about how can I be a good trumpet player, you know.
Yeah.
And that whole other thing is a different topic altogether. And it's very rare that people get that opportunity to actually toss around those ideas.
But part of that is of course, what you feel when you play to an audience, right? The audience feedback is a big part of development once you get out there with your sound.
Oh, sure. I mean, my career is basically built on word of mouth. I'm an artist that doesn't have a hit song or a hit. Yeah, my hit song, I guess. You know, like a singer has a, well, what song did they do? Well, they did this. You know, my success is built on a great band and a great live show and people saying, oh, you got to see this. I mean, I use San Francisco as an example. You know, we, albeit it was like a couple of weeks after 9/11, but we went into San Francisco and my band outnumbered the audience. There was four people in the audience and six people in our band.
Uh-huh.
And then slowly but surely, we keep going back and back and back. And, you know, now we go and there are many thousands of people there. And that's just sort of like old school word of mouth and working it. And that's something that's longevity, you know, sustaining. And then I'm real proud of that.
Well, a lot of musicians in their early days run into that thing of outnumbering the audience up on the bandstand. And, you know, it's not for the faint of heart, right? It's easy to get discouraged by that.
Sure. You know, but I think that, at least for me, you know, I had a real kind of healthy dash of naivete. You know, I mean, I think, you know, if I were to go back and look at my career and say, well, I was playing on the streets in New York, Christmas carols, and, you know, but at the time, if I made $20 playing in the streets in New York Christmas carols, I thought I'd won the Academy Award, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't think of it as a bad thing. And I think that not getting down on yourself or depressed by the actual reality of what you were doing day to day made it so that you could have the rosier, you know, rose-colored glasses that would enable it to, when it was great, then it would be more real.
Sure, that $20 does feel like a really important $20, and then of course when you do play,
especially
for,
then,
yeah, I'm sure it's gets a couple of meals at least, right? But then when you reach, it also enhances the reward when you do get to that point of playing for a large audience, I would think.
Correct, and not, you know, you go through, you know, shifts in your career. You know, you go through. You know, can I play with these musicians? Then all of a sudden, I'm playing with more famous musicians, and then all of a sudden, I'm not playing really horrible gigs, and I'm not playing weddings, and I'm not playing. You know, it doesn't happen overnight. It's a gradual sort of change, and then things start moving rapidly when you start really reaching a wide audience or becoming well known or being stopped in an airport or something like that. That stuff happens more on the faster side than you'd think.
And then when that career momentum picks up, there are things that you need to hang on to from earlier on, right? You know, you have to still remain on top of your craft.
Well, I'm probably practicing more now than I ever have. And I did the kind of the weirdest thing. I was living in Los Angeles for 5 years, and I basically woke up one day and I sold everything I owned. Like, I mean, I sold my apartment, my cars, and blah, 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 blah. And I moved into a hotel in New York. So I live full time in a hotel. And because I'm in the situation I'm in now and I don't have to work, et cetera, I wake up every morning and I walk across to a music school and I practice every day for 4 or 5 hours a day. And that, it sort of puts me in a real routine that I like. And it also reminds me of when I went to college, and I hear other little kids playing the piano and stuff. And I think that puts me in a real good mindset. So I've been practicing more and I'm more focused even. The trumpet's an instrument you have to practice a couple hours a day anyhow, no matter what.
Sure is,
but,
yeah.
But I've been playing a lot more than that and being more focused and more because I recognize my good fortune. I also want to get better. I want to learn. You know, you have to like do 2 or 3 hours a day for maintenance, and then the other 2 or 3 hours a day is to try to get better and see how that infiltrates your sound and your playing over time.
Well, I think that's the kind of story that might well inspire younger musicians, because younger players need to find out just exactly what it is they've bought into, don't they?
Oh, boy. Yeah, if you're a young musician, you're listening, you want to be, instrumentalist, I congratulate you wholeheartedly and have a lot of respect for people that want to take that leap, because it is daunting nowadays. It's not for someone that's just kind of half in. You got to be all in.
Chris Bode will perform at Blue Note Hawaii in Waikiki from Tuesday through Sunday of next week.
Aloha, this is Judy Anderson, your evening concert host.
And I'm Gene Schiller, your early rising music director.
We keep our promises here at HPR, don't we, Gene?
We do. It's been 35 years in the making, but on February 14th, we finally have an all-classical music station on HPR2.
So our information and alternate music programs will be shifting over to join the news magazines on HPR1?
Yep, and it all starts on February 14th. Two distinct environments for your listening pleasure, from morning till night.
Beth Ann, I'm always, when I talk to musicians, I'm always trying to find lessons about excellence and what it takes. And what Chris Bode said is applies perfectly. You've got to be all in.
All in, and maybe having to live through some of those really horrible gigs that
exactly.
He didn't exactly go into, but kind of reminded me of that scene in La La Land where the protagonist is having to play in an 80s cover band. You got to go through a lot of that slog to be able to do what you want to do if you really want to do it.
Well, they say rock musicians play 3 chords for 1,000 people, and jazz musicians play 1,000 chords for 3 people.
And we could talk to you about what you think is better, but that's another conversation. Meanwhile, we've got a pretty momentous week coming up.
We do indeed.
And we'll be back with you on Monday. And we're going to have a wrap of this weekend's Hawaii School Empowerment Conference, also the 2017 Hawaii Harm Reduction Conference.
And we'll be learning how to be a stunt performer without breaking your neck.
We hope so. Well, in the meantime, you can be in touch, and you don't have to break your neck either. All you have to do is call our talkback line. Leave us your comments. The number is 808-792-8217. Please also leave us your name and the town from which you're calling. You can email us if you'd prefer. That's talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, or post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
You can hear today's show again or get another past show on the Conversation page on the HPR website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you Monday when we pick up the conversation. Enjoy your weekend.